This is a 2012 postscript to Who Killed Mum, an essay I wrote called Watching TV with Dad. I'm lost, my father says. I don't have a clue what it's all about. An astute observation, but misleading. Dad is not generalizing. He's talking about a TV show, however well the statement may work out of context. Since I last saw him at Christmas, Dad has traveled another long mile into the gathering fog. Whether the issue is Alzheimer's or some more generic brand of dementia will only be revealed post-mortem, if anybody cares. It doesn't matter much. For now, the TV in Dad's apartment has become its own kind of diagnostic tool. Watching TV with Dad is like illuminating the map of fissures and craters that now scar his mental moonscape. It's educational. For one of us, anyway. It's been years since a doctor first told Dad he has early-stage Alzheimer's. Dad refused to accept it, and my siblings and I have been inclined towards skepticism as well. Most Alzheimer's case studies talk about personality changes, trapped rage released from dark recesses. Nothing like that with Dad. Only increasing forgetfulness, delusions, and befuddlement. But that may simply be confirmation of what we always knew, that Dad's teddy bear exterior concealed a heart made of sunshine and candy corn. Even sunny old Dad is getting a little down these days. He's been dealt a triple whammy. Joan, his beloved wife of 58 years, died 3 years ago. Now his eyes are keeping pace with his fading memory and a race to oblivion. Macular degeneration has taken hold. Dad is nearly blind. In order to remember things, he writes them down. Then, unable to read what he's written or remember what he wrote, he writes them again, ad infinitum, until his tabletop day planner is an illegible black mass of Sharpie doodles. When you consider that aging is his only crime, it suggests karma is not so much a bitch as a random psychopath. But tonight's entry in Dad's ongoing diary of disorientation is really my fault. I picked the TV show. Baseball games are just about the only televised events he can successfully engage with. They combine familiar patterns and rhythms with a pace slow enough to give him a chance. But there are no games on tonight, so I decided that, since he will find anything else equally perplexing, I might as well watch what I choose. My choice? The Pitch, an AMC reality show about advertising firms. If my intention had been to play a cruel practical joke on Dad, I could not have chosen better. The people on screen are competing for an advertising contract, talking about creating viral videos, uploading content, etc. Perplexity is Dad's current default position while watching TV at the best of times, but this show really wallops him. His usual stream of repetitive questions has been replaced by the all-purpose remark I quoted earlier. Dad doesn't even have a frame of reference for this stuff. Things are getting worse. The diagnostic TV reveals it. I've heard others tell of watching their parents cross that line where reality and televised drama begin to fuse, and I think it's starting to happen with Dad. Several days earlier, Dad and I had been up at a cabin at Clear Lake, Manitoba. I turned on the stovetop, made some of my signature cottage mix of popcorn and small enamel cracking charcoal nuggets, then desperately scrolled through the satellite signals for something Dad might enjoy. I found CPAC, the Canadian parliamentary channel. Contrary to what you might expect, this was a score. Pundit Andrew Coyne was debating former cabinet minister Sheila Copps on the issue of prime ministerial power. Dad seemed enthralled. I felt it was safe to leave him there and run an errand. When I returned, 20 minutes later, I found him pacing about, agitated. "Steve," he asked, "what are our responsibilities?" A stumper. "Well, Dad," I answered, "we're just here to relax." "Don't we have responsibilities?" he asked. "Making the world a better place?" "Not this weekend, Dad." "What was that all about earlier? Weren't there some people here? What are our responsibilities?" Even after I put him to bed, he kept calling out. "Do we have goals? Responsibilities?" If this is the nature of Dad's decline, it's typical. Dementia is supposed to release the id. A friend of mine described his mother's descent into Alzheimer's as a sort of mental zookeeper strike, with caged anger and cruelty suddenly unleashed after a lifetime of restraint. Now here I was, facing the unchained impulses of my father's subconscious. And they were? An urgent desire to shoulder his responsibilities and make the world a better place. Nice to know I'm unlikely to hear any long-repressed anecdotes about being forced to kill a drifter in a freight yard. Another question came from Dad's darkened bedroom that evening. "What happened to Mum?" he called out. "She left me rudderless." Dad has a disarming way of combining confusion with clarity. That question has been coming a lot lately. "What news do you have about Mum?" he asks. "Is she with her parents?" "It's possible," we tell him. Initially, Dad's new line of inquiry landed in the family like a grenade. Here at last his situation had crossed from the sad to the surreal. First, we faced the unexpected task of swallowing incredulity and evenly explaining that he had attended his wife's funeral 3 years earlier, followed immediately by the realization that in our ongoing search for subtle clues concerning Dad's mental state, we might as well have been using flashlights at noon. And several months later, the new normal is, if not exactly comfortable, familiar. As was the case during my mother's inexorable decline, we find ourselves cycling rapidly through appalled and adapting to resigned. When our phones ring in the evenings, my siblings and I are now practiced as parents on a long car trip, fielding the usual queries from the back seat. "Mum's been gone 3 years, Dad." "3 years? Really? How long did we have together? It didn't seem like very long. I wanted more." We can't break the habit of explaining things to him. It's not the sort of habit one ever expects to have to break. The simple idea that one's statements will inspire appropriate responses, or at least register for longer than a blush, is so deeply ingrained that it's almost impossible to shake. We'll prattle on about our lives, discuss the details of news stories, make reference to movies or books, every word drifting off into the ether and vaporizing. We might as well be Japanese tourists in a Serbian village, doggedly explaining our travel plans to a politely nodding local. But we keep talking. Tonight, Dad's befuddlement is focused on the TV show I have so cruelly forced upon him. He's trying to find a foothold somewhere. "It's about advertising," he says. "Did you ever meet your Uncle Stan? That was his job." "You knew Uncle Stan well? Really? How did you meet him?" "We should phone him and see how he's doing." Uncle Stan has been dead a week longer than my mother. No matter. These topics disappear faster than Higgs boson. Somebody at the ad agency is now supervising a recording session. "Drums!" Dad says. This is TV functioning at the Teletubbies level. Watching Dad watch the show, it occurs to me that he may finally be well-positioned to enjoy the sort of Hollywood blockbusters that once left him cold. Catering to the modern attention span has inadvertently led to an Alzheimer's-friendly cinematic genre. As long as you don't care what's blowing up, knock yourself out. But now the scene shifts, and it's my turn to be at a loss. Apparently, the ad agency teams are making their pitches to the client in San Francisco. The camera points skyward as they roll under the familiar towers of the Golden Gate Bridge. I'm silent, and for the moment, grateful for Dad's lack of awareness. My father is the only member of our family for whom that famous bridge will never have painful associations. He does not know it has just taken his oldest grandchild. My oldest brother Joe had one son. His name was Josh. An aimless teenager, aren't they all, we said? But not every trajectory corrects in young adulthood. Josh became a frustrated young man. He didn't lack for plans, of a sort. He would be a professional poker player, he decided. Or better yet, an NFL place kicker. The idea showed a certain slacker genius. Josh had some athletic ability. And what are NFL place kickers but high-paid professional athletes who mostly stand around, maybe smoking a few while they await their moment? Josh was upset at Joe for not helping him realize that dream. No one, it seemed to Josh, wanted to help. He developed habits. A serious accident while driving a cab under the influence of something or other led to a stretch of California jail time. Now in his early 30s, and back living in the San Francisco area where he had grown up, he was trying to keep himself straight. I had spoken to him on the phone while I was in Brandon for what would prove to be my mother's final Christmas. Josh loved my parents, and that evening, I could tell he was craving family connection. But he was fragile, defensive. He never seemed to have coalesced into viable adulthood. Josh liked talking to me because we shared something. My previous history of problem drinking meant I could relate to his struggles. Yet, I shied away from Josh. He told his father he wanted to come stay with me in Vancouver. Last Christmas, Joe had handed me a paper with Josh's phone number on it. I tucked it into my shirt pocket. I didn't even have a cat anymore. Babysitting a needy nephew was not on. I knew that phone calls to each of Josh's parents typically devolved into long harangues and chronicles of injustice. I wasn't about to get caught by the family tar baby. That slip of paper stayed in my shirt until April, one laundry day, when it would catch my fingers like an open safety pin. In March, Josh incurred a minor traffic violation that threatened to endanger his hard-won cab license. He was panicked and despondent. One morning, just after the third anniversary of our mother's death, Joe's phone rang. The screen said, "Josh." It was a work day. Joe did not have time for a half-hour conversation. It could wait. Joe would check the voicemail message later, after the coroner called with the news. Nothing but noise. Had Josh called from the bridge? Or was it an accidental call, perhaps caused by the impact with the water? Witnesses had seen him go from lamppost 103 on the east side of the Golden Gate, facing the city. A couple of small blessings. His body had been caught by the west side of the tower base. Some are never found. And he looked as pristine as the corpses you see on those bullshit crime shows. Josh had always been a good-looking kid. Now I sit with Dad, looking at the Golden Gate Bridge on a TV show he does not understand. It's cruel. A time of tragedy for our family, his family, and he doesn't know. But the alternative would be crueler still. In my book, I mused about a possible heaven for my father, one borrowed from the Japanese movie Afterlife. It involves a single perfect moment relived endlessly, always new, always joyful, on an eternal loop. But events have now given us a glimpse of that vision's opposite, the fresh hell of a repeating tragedy, told, forgotten, told again, on and on to a vanishing point of grief and guilt and pain. We can at least spare him that. Dad will never hear the news of Josh's death. The advertising agencies have made their pitches. One of the execs is expounding on his firm's creative philosophy. "You've got to do something they'll never forget," he proclaims. "There's nothing I'll never forget," Dad cracks, "except a certain redhead." That's the unexpected comfort in this downward spiral. Dad's brain may be cheesecloth, but in those narrow bands of function and interaction that do not require recent recall or prolonged narrative comprehension, he's still himself. His outlook has survived. He probably couldn't follow the plot of a soup commercial, but he can express the contents of his soul. He's still alive. "So," Dad says, "what is this we're watching?" This is Steve Burgess. You've been listening to an unabridged production of Who Killed Mom? A Delinquent Son's Meditation on Family, Mortality, and Very Tacky Candles. Executive producer, Carlin Craig. Assistant producer, Stacy Sellers. Text, copyright 2012 by Steve Burgess. Production, copyright 2012 by Post-Hypnotic Press. All rights reserved. Published by arrangement with Greystone, an imprint of Douglas & McIntyre. Acknowledgements. I could not have written this book without coffee. My thanks to the staff and management at various locations of Café Artigiano around Vancouver and to the 49th Parallel Coffee Roasters Café in Kitsilano. Truly, your work has helped fuel this enterprise. The dedication of this book underlines my deep gratitude to Swerve editor Shelley Youngblood. In 2006, Swerve published my essay, I'm Santa Now. A reader requested an update. Casablanca Christmas appeared the following year. In 2009, Shelley published Dance Me to the End of Love about my mother's final days. The response from Swerve readers convinced Shelley, who convinced me, that I should write this book. I'm very grateful to all those Swervers. You showed me that this could be more than just a personal family story. And most of all, I thank Shelley for being one of those special magazine editors whose top priority is writers and writing. Matthew Mallon helped shape this project early on, and I have drawn in his stories and pilfered from his vast cultural knowledge. David Beers, another great editor, has been a mentor and guide through years of fruitless fumbling. His reward is in heaven, probably. Certainly not here. Thanks to Maya Brown for her one-woman focus groups. When I joined the Kaspar family for dinner in Rome, Sienna did not realize she and her husband would play a pivotal role in this book. My heartfelt thanks to them both, and to my friend Colleen Christie for all her tremendous help, input, and support. Laura Murdoch also let me tell some tales. Thanks, Laura. It may be cheesy to thank your agent, but Rick Broadhead actually taught me how to construct a book proposal, lessons that were not directly paid for. I owe him for that. Is it also cheesy to thank your publisher? I realize Rob Sanders is in this to make a buck. Never mind. Rob took a chance after a lot of other people said, I really like this, but the answer is no, because maybe it won't sell. Thanks to my editor, Peter Norman, whose affability robbed me of the opportunity to throw artistic tantrums. Thanks also to Laura Kordick for a fine and fine-tooth copy edit. Thanks to George Clooney and President Obama. Mentioning their names here adds cachet, and I'm grateful for that. Many writers thank their spouses and say, I couldn't have done it without you. I am proof that it is possible. I do have siblings, though. Joe, Lynn, Jock, and Leslie helped me immeasurably. Not to start any family fights here, but when it came to quotes, anecdotes, and factual information, Lynn was the undisputed champ. I beg you all, do not let this statement interfere with the harmony of future family dinners. My cousin John Slorence helped a lot. Thanks, John. Cousin Kendall Matz was great, too. My aunt, Margaret Osborne, was very generous with her reminiscences of Slorence family life. She passed away on June 2, 2010, at her cottage overlooking Audie Lake. She was the last of the Slorence children. I was grateful for her gracious assistance and only wish there had been time to ask for more. Outside of my own recollections, my father was the primary source of information for this book. I've tried to repay him by teaching him the lyrics to Glowworm, whereas our recent attempt to remember all the words to Pennies from Heaven was more of a research collaboration. Thanks for everything, Dad. I really hope you like it.